the Accidental Safety Pro, brought to you by Vivid Learning Systems and the Health and Safety Institute, episode number 11. My name is Jill James, Vivid's Chief Safety Officer, and today I'm joined by Mark, who is a consulting industrial hygienist who recently left private sector employment and is working out of Columbia, Maryland. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jill. Glad to be here.
So, Mark, leaving private sector for consulting, that's kind of a big deal. How many years had you been in private sector?
I started working in 1981, so just finished 36 years.
Wow.
And it's pretty exciting to do sort of work on my own and hoping for the best.
So 36 years in the role of industrial hygiene.
Right. And in that, you know, like many of us, you know, I've often been a generalist, so, you know, done safety work and environmental work, part of all that, but I sort of like to keep my grounding as an industrial hygienist.
Right. So, Mark, the centerpiece of this podcast is asking how people accidentally came into the health and safety practice. And going back a number of years for you, what did that look like back then? I mean, OSHA had been around for a little, you said 1986, so
1981,
coming up.
Yeah.
Oh, 1981, so just a little over a decade.
Yeah, and you know, I was an undergrad in the mid to late 70s and in graduate school a little bit, and I grew up in a blue-collar family in Akron, Ohio, so most of my relatives worked in the rubber shops, and you know, I didn't do that sort of work, but had a sense of what that kind of work was like. But I was at the University of Akron State University, first of my family to go to college, so I was, and this was a number of years after Earth Day, so I was really planning to have an environmental career and be an environmental scientist and work on air and water pollution and those sorts of issues. Mm-hmm. And near the end of my undergraduate time, I actually ran into a guy who worked for Federal OSHA. He was an inspector for Federal OSHA. Mm-hmm. And he described his work as environmental work inside factories. And that just opened up this whole world that I really hadn't known about in terms of occupational safety and health as a possibility to me, and sort of led me in that direction. And it was the perfect thing for him to say because it led me to this marvelous career the last 30 plus years.
Wow, how interesting. Because before in your head, you were just thinking about, like you said, you were thinking about celebrating Earth Day. So you're really thinking about the things that were more impacting the environment in our outside world, not necessarily what was happening to people inside the places where they live, where they worked.
Right. And my family were, as I said, my family were blue collar workers. My father and mother had worked in the rubber shops. My dad ended up being a mechanic. My uncles all worked in the rubber shops. So, you know, and I had, you know, a little bit of awareness of some of the health issues and safety issues, but the idea that this could be something I would focus my scientific interest on and I could use as work was something that never crossed my mind. But it's interesting when you look back on it historically, there was actually occupational safety and health was a part of Earth Day and a part of a lot of the environmental discussions back in the late 60s and up until the time OSHA was passed. So folks back then, a lot of those folks who did environmental work saw occupational health as a part of their work.
Yeah, very interesting. And so having had the blue-collar background that you did with your family, as did I, I think it's probably the first thing I often think about is where those roots are whenever I'm applying my safety background, is thinking about, you know, how would have this impacted my family or the factory where my dad worked? Is that a lens that you've looked throughout your career?
It has been, and you know, and I think I think especially of several of my uncles who worked in the rubber shops, and some of who ended up with work-related asthma, and some with asbestosis over the years back from you know, they started work back in the 40s or 50s. So you know, working to improve conditions in workplaces like that really was just really exciting, and really felt good to do this sort of work. And when I go out to work sites, often it would, especially early on when I was, you know, when you're younger and you go out to industrial work sites with a bunch of older workers, you can be intimidated because, you know, they've been around a long time and you're brand new.
Right.
But I would look at a lot of these guys and think, oh yeah, this could be my father. These could be my uncles. And, you know, and I, you know, felt comfortable talking to them. So it made it easier to do this work.
Yeah.
It also gave me some pushback because I remember my you know, my uncles would and my father would sometimes come home and talk about the work study people who were in there, and they, you know, they were
causing trouble,
and they were reviled by most of the workers that, you know, the relatives I knew. And so I remember one of my earliest sampling. I was in a sampling in a warehouse for carbon monoxide with Draeger tubes, and you know, you're pulling the Draeger tubes and you're waiting. And I realized at one point, none of these guys in the warehouse knew why I was there. No one had told them why I was there. And I had this shudder that went up my spine at that, oh my God, they probably think I'm works. They probably think I'm time study. They probably hate me.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need to let, you know, I need to make sure people know why I'm there when I'm doing my work. And so, you know, that's something I've always tried to do, is make sure either the employer or the whoever has brought me in, or that I'm able to tell people why I'm doing the work. And, you know, you both get feedback from people and insight that you might not have gotten otherwise, but also gives them a positive sense of why I'm there as opposed to time study.
That's so true. That often was part of my work when I was an investigator with OSHA. You go into a factory and, you know, the expectation of the investigator, the governor, government rather, was that you're wearing a hard hat with a government logo on it.
Yeah.
And immediately that makes people fearful, depending on where they're working and what they're doing. And so when I got into facilities, most of the time I would ask if there was company personal protective equipment that I could wear so that I wasn't standing out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these kind of factories are like have color coding, like a certain color means a certain rank, if you will,
right,
in a facility. And so I'm like, don't give me whatever is like the top one, because I don't want to scare people, and I don't want this government logo on me, because that also scares people. And then, you know, always really careful when I interviewed employees to explain what my purpose was, and that my purpose was to ensure their health and safety, and it wasn't to find fault with what they were doing when I was asking them questions like, tell me how this machine works, you know?
right. And that was part of what I found too, was especially it was as I was younger, it was easier to be able to ask, explain this process to me, or I think this is what I'm seeing, is that how this really happens. And you know, and a lot of, you know, mostly workers are really happy to tell you about their work and how things work and what they think could be done to make it better, if they feel like that you're at least a trusted source, or they don't think you're going to do harm.
Right, exactly. So you got your start, you realized you could do your work in industry. What was that first job? What did you pursue?
Well, it was interesting. The first job I had been going to school in Akron, Ohio, and my wife and I had moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I was looking after graduate school. So I was looking for work there. And I actually applied for and got a job as in the health and safety department of an industrial union, a labor union.
Okay.
And so my blue collar family had all been union members, and I knew, you know, I knew what unions were in general, and, you know, but it wasn't, I hadn't worked with as a union member. But the idea that I could work for a union doing health and safety and using science just was even better, because it was like, wow, I can be working to help my, you know, again, people like my relatives and my father and my mother, doing this work. And I hadn't realized unions actually hired staff. And so it was really
right?
fun to do this. And actually the other part, the position was actually funded by a federal OSHA grant under an old program that they called the New Directions Program, to encourage organizations to build capacity. So it also gave me a link then into some OSHA, kind of directly into OSHA issues. It was a marvelous first job. The organization was the Allied Industrial Workers Union, that was based out of Milwaukee. They were a small industrial union that represented workers mostly in the Midwest, and mostly at small plants, auto parts, but a whole range of other kind of workplaces, from grain elevators to metal plating operations. So it gave me this real interesting chance to see a lot of, you know, medium to small facilities of a lot of different types. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I only looked at foundries. I'm thinking of some of the places we went to, foundries, and it gave me a chance to see a whole lot of types of work sites that were small and medium, instead of, you know, had I, you know, gotten a job at a large corporate employer that had one major focus like the auto industry, then you see a much narrower range of work sites.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely an advantage to be able to see so many places of employment where people are doing their work. When you were doing that work, was it primarily industrial hygiene, or was safety starting to kind of sneak into that as well?
Yeah, I ended up being a generalist. There were actually two of us in the health and safety program. The union had about 120,000 members and represented workers at probably about two or 300 work sites. So we would do sort of basic health and safety work, industrial hygiene work occasionally, some sampling. The warehouse sampling that I mentioned, I had actually done through the union, where we offered as a union that we would do this as a service for free for an employer where we had concerns about carbon monoxide, and the employer was willing to let us come in and do that testing, and didn't cost them anything. They didn't have to hire an outside consultant. And so And we had good relationships with that employer so that they would be willing to work with us based on the results. Mm-hmm. So there was that. There would be safety issues that would come in that, you know, I felt completely unexperienced to work on. But the director of our program, who was the other staff person, was a wonderful man named Milan Rasek. And he had been a longtime OSHA industrial hygienist, had been the first industrial hygienist in Wisconsin, and had done health and safety work since the mid-60s. And so he had this like almost 20 years of experience by the time I came to work for him. And so he became this really incredible mentor because he had this huge, broad experience having worked with OSHA. And as you know, because your work with OSHA, broad that experience gets to be.
It absolutely is. I wanted to mention, you brought up a point that I'm wondering if some of our listeners might not know. You had mentioned that you're able to do industrial hygiene monitoring for these places of employment where there was union representation. You're able to do it free for the employer. And so as many of us are going about doing our work and we're thinking, you know, like, how do I have access to resources and where can I go? Because many of us, safety professionals, safety and health professionals, don't have a budget. And so you're trying to figure out creative ways to get what you need. And so I think that's a really good tip to remind people where they have union representation, that they could ask their union if they have someone like you who would be able to help them.
Yeah. And not as many workplaces are unionized as they were when I started back in 1981, but most major unions have health and safety staff at their internationals. Some large local unions will even have health and safety staff that may be full or part-time and available to help. And lots of unions have trained members who are trained in safety and health. And you may be surprised how much training some of the folks get. The United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers Union, and other unions actually have these extensive internal training programs to train members who are on health and safety committees and members to be advocate for health and safety and help resolve issues. And it can be it's an incredibly powerful way to take care of health and safety issues where you have good relationships between the employer and the union and the members. Mm-hmm. And you can really come up with some really wonderful solutions to problems sort of internally without having to bring in, either outside consultants, but without OSHA being part of that.
Right. Smart. So I know, Mark, that your career took you on a journey all the way to Alaska. And I'm interested to have you tell that story. Was that after this job that you were just talking about?
Yeah, I worked for a couple years for the Allied Industrial Workers Union, and that was funded primarily by this OSHA New Directions grant. And then that grant funding ended. It was meant to help develop capacity. The funding ended. Unfortunately, at the time the funding ended, there was a big recession going on in the Midwest, and the union I was working for had lost almost half its membership. And so I was laid off because it just wasn't funding to they were trying to hold it together. So I ended up applying for a job in Anchorage, Alaska, working for a community nonprofit called the Alaska Health Project. And it was an organization that did occupational and environmental health work for the state of Alaska as a community resource nonprofit.
Oh, wow.
And there are organizations like that around the country. There are now about 20 of them, and they're generally called committees on occupational safety and health, but they have various names. And they and they're nonprofit, community-based organizations, often that work with organized labor, but can work with employers and others to advance occupational environmental health work. And so I came to Alaska in the summer of 1984 and came to work with this group, thinking that, and they were primarily grant funded. So the grant I was going to work under had a 1 year time frame to it, possibility of an extension on it. But I said, you know, I always wanted to visit Alaska, and I thought, wow, moving to Alaska for a year and working would be really cool. And
was your wife thinking the same thing?
She was. She was actually a biologist naturalist, and so we both had wanted to visit Alaska. So so we drove up right around solstice. The sun was never setting as we drove. We drove all the way across the country to Seattle and up to Vancouver, and then took this ferry system up, and then got off in Haines, Alaska. And from, you get up to Haines and you think you're at the end of the world if you're not from there. And then it's 800 miles down the Yaukan Highway to get to Anchorage.
Oh my gosh.
And so we I remember driving into Anchorage at sort of near solstice on the in the middle of the summer, and the sun not setting as, you know, it's midnight, and we're driving into Anchorage, and it was the beginning of the most amazing journey. And both personally, but work-wise, was really just quite remarkable. So one of the, it was probably the best thing I did as a young hygienist, was to take that job and be willing to move to Alaska and see what happened.
Yeah. And so what did happen? Was it a game changer for you and your career?
It really was. I mean, first of all, I had really liked the industrial hygiene and the occupational health and safety work, but I still had this tug that I really thought about environmental work and going back to that, and finishing graduate school and going back to work in environmental work. But the years of working in Alaska, I was up there for almost 7 years, that really solidified that occupational health work was what I wanted to stay in and do. And occasionally I get involved in environmental work, which is always fun, but primarily my, you know, that was the kind of change to sort of stay in this profession.
Mm-hmm. So how long did the two of you stay in Alaska?
We were in Alaska until the early 1991, and I ended up moving to Seattle to work at the University of Washington at their School of Public Health Occupational Medicine Clinic. So it was a big reason to leave, but
what a big shift.
Yeah, it was a really wonderful, that was another wonderful position. I've been really fortunate in my career to keep sort of finding a succession of really wonderful jobs and wonderful people to work with. I had actually just bought a house, and I had finally bought a house in Anchorage about 1990, and it was shortly after buying the house that the opportunity in Seattle opened up, and then we decided to move there, and that was also another sort of wonderful choice. But Alaska was this, for a young hygienist with a few years' experience, I moved there, and one of the things I learned early on was there were like 10 or 15 hygienists in the entire state. Now, it's a huge territory, but it was only 500,000 people. But to be working for this sort of nonprofit that provided community help, I remember an experience of being in Fairbanks for the first time, and I had some free time, and I looked in the Yellow Pages and went to the one safety supply store that existed in Fairbanks in 1984, and I went in and I was looking around, and I introduced myself to the staff behind the counter, and when he found out I was an industrial hygienist, he like jumped over the counter and came up to shake my hand. He wanted my card, he wanted to know how he could call me, because he said, there's so few of you here, this is great to know somebody. And so that was a lot of the reaction was that, I mean,
wow.
People were and so, you
a
know,
famous IH.
Yeah, I had never had that reaction before. And And it was also being, you know, fairly, you know, only having 3 years experience to have people, you know, really be basic. I remember I got a call from a worker in a remote village far at a school district in the far northern part of the state on the Arctic Ocean. And he was asking me a question about calibrating a pump because he was going to do he needed to do air sampling for asbestos. Mm-hmm. And this was early on in the asbestos issues. And I remember my first thought was, well, I can't tell you how to calibrate the pump by long distance. And he said, well, he said, I got trained and I'm not sure if I'm doing it right. He says, you can either help me or I'll just do whatever I think right. So I'd rather have your help. So it was like, okay, I can, you know, I did my best to help him. And
talking
so,
through it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of like, well, welcome to Alaska, you know.
Oh, how fascinating. Yeah. And so I bet you put a lot of miles on whatever vehicle you had.
I did, and actually, a lot of the miles ended up being when I first moved there. One of the things that the director of the organization said is we want to do more work in rural Alaska off the road system. And he said the group had only been around for 3 years at that point, so they were fairly new. Mm-hmm. And I remember my director Larry Weiss. He said we also want to do more work with the Native community because the Native community is an underserved group here. They have mm-hmm. occupational, environmental, health concerns, and we mm-hmm. should do what we can to help. And so my arrival kind of coincided with a lot of focus on asbestos issues. And so what had happened is, and there's a complex history of essentially the Native populations in Alaska got ownership of 1/3 of the state, and a lot of prior land that used to be federal land was turned over and was being turned over to the Natives as their private property and to run their mm-hmm. corporations to earn money and jobs for Native peoples. Mm-hmm. And so the issue, a lot of the buildings that had gotten turned over that were schools or other buildings that had been turned over to the feds were full of asbestos. So the Native populations were now asking questions and having to deal with asbestos rules that were, in a way, HERA was coming up shortly after that for asbestos in schools. And so I remember early on, after a HERA passed in 1986, going up to a mountain village and training all of their school maintenance workers. And there was about 50 of those school maintenance workers, many of whom were bilingual, but some who only spoke the Native language, Yupik.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. I remember doing a class where every so often they'd ask me to stop, and there were a couple old timers, old maintenance workers, and then there would be people would translate in Yupik what I had just said.
Man,
it was fascinating. And,
yeah.
But you know, we did part of the training was hands-on. And if I had any doubts that people were understanding what I was talking about, when we did the hands-on parts on glove bagging and controls and other things,
sure.
they were great. I mean, they got the idea, and they were doing a good
job. They were demonstrated
that they really knew what, that they could do the work.
So you're doing training. Had you been much of a public speaker before? Was some of this work some of your first, like, in front of an audience? Like, how did that go for you?
When I was in high school, I was one of those really shy, kind of nerdy scientists, and so science students, and so I hardly talked at all. And so one of the things I knew when I got to college was that there were two things I realized I needed to change. One was my fear of public speaking. I needed to not be terrified because I knew that would limit my future. Sure. The other one is I had this terrible fear of heights. And so the two things I did was I took up rock climbing and I did that. And that got over the fear of heights. The other thing I did is I joined organizations and I put myself in positions where I had to do public speaking, usually around environmental issues that I had an interest in. And then I got involved in, as I got into school longer, I got involved in some teaching. I got involved in some opportunity to do teaching. So I had to get up in front of a class. And I was terrified. And I would turn bright red and I'd stutter and I'd make all the mistakes you could make. But after like 100 times, you know, it got easier.
And, so it takes 100 times.
Yeah. And so when I had my first hygiene job in Milwaukee and then the job in Anchorage, it was getting easier to do the public speaking because I had been gaining this experience. It still was, you know, still something that would give me butterflies ahead of time, and
sure,
and I would still turn red. I just, you know, and you know, people were usually pretty kind about it. One of the things I recall was someone early on when I was trying to do public speaking said, you know, most people are way more terrified that they're thinking, oh my God, I don't want to be up there. I'm glad he's up there. So he said, people are usually sympathetic because they don't want to be there. They're glad you're up there. Mm-hmm, that made it easier to think about doing this work.
Yeah, that is true. That's a good tip. I challenged myself a number of years ago to never turn down any request for speaking.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted to kind of hone that skill and get better at it. And it's still a craft I'm working on. And I love doing it. And I don't necessarily I never had that really big fear, but I still get butterflies. I still get nervous. I still get jittery. And if I don't, those are the times that I usually don't do well. But there's specific public speaking that I don't like doing. And it's reading anything that's not my own words out loud. So when I made this promise to myself about I won't turn down any public speaking, that included if I got asked to read something in church.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, it's a public speaking thing. It's a microphone. It's a podium. I have to say yes. And so I say yes. And I just don't like it. It still makes me more nervous than anything else because I'm worried I'm going to, you know, skip a line or I'm going to miss something or I'm going to see something out of the corner of my eye and I'm going to get distracted and I'm going to super embarrass myself and I won't even have known I did it.
Right.
So well, those are the times that make me most nervous.
Right. And after a while, you embarrass yourself enough times that you get better and you get over that. But it's, but it's interesting. I look back and that was probably one of the really key things that was not part of my, thinking, learning my science and developing my skills as an environmental scientist was what I thought was the most important, but probably one of the more important things was doing public speaking.
Yeah.
Because if you can't do that well, or if you don't work on that and you're not willing to do it, it really does limit what you do. Mm-hmm. I would have never taken that first job with the Allied Industrial Workers Union, because part of that job was going to be doing teaching of our union members and speaking out in public forums like OSHA hearings and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I would have, if I would have just said no, I would have never, I would have never had the opportunity to do all this really amazing work. So in high school, I wanted to work. I knew I wanted to do environmental work, but I decided I should work in a laboratory where I never had to talk to people. And, thank goodness
that would have been a limiter. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness you don't get what you wish for sometimes, right? So, I've had this most amazing, 30 plus years of doing really wonderful work that I feel good about. There's a satisfaction to the work we do, right? Most days, the last 30 plus years, I wake up thinking I get to go to work today, which is
And you always get something new,
and
you're never done learning. Someone asked me yesterday for help with nanotechnology and safety. This is a land that I do not know, but I'm absolutely committed to finding out. And so it was one of the more fun parts of my work week because it was something different. And I get to dig into some research and find out, how can I help? How can I help this individual source some information? So there's never a dull moment in our career.
Yeah. And that's something that I've found about the health and safety work. It's been both challenging, but it's also so variable. I started out at doing sort of health and safety work in industrial plants. Pretty straightforward, not necessarily straightforward, but pretty common type of work. I mean, the work I just left with the Service Employees International Union, the major focus of my work the last 4 or 5 years, that's been workplace violence prevention and dealing with workplace violence. I would have never guessed in 1981 that I was going to deal with workplace violence. But it's a major issue in healthcare. We had lots of healthcare members, especially nurses, and this was a major issue that we worked on. And so you have to learn it, you have to be adaptable, and you have to do your best.
Yeah, I know that I know a little bit about that work that you did with workplace violence, and you had mentioned a minute ago about testifying at OSHA hearings as well as another place that you were able to hone and test your public speaking skills, and that leads me to wonder what was it like with the OSHA hearings? How did that happen for you, and have you been called upon numbers of times in your career to do that? And what were the outcomes with those?
Yeah, well, I've had actually lots of opportunities to sort of speak in policy meetings, whether it's often OSHA public hearings, but also in more informal meetings with NIOSH and Institute of Medicine and National Academy of Science and others. So, it's the more formal like ones like the federal and state OSHA regulatory hearings. They're more formalized and there's less sort of interaction, and so those are useful because the outcomes are so powerful. A national OSHA regulation or a state based regulation can have an impact on a lot of workplaces. I enjoy more the sort of more informal and the sort of interaction that happens with some of the other meetings, say with NIOSH or with the National Academy of Science, where there's more discussion interaction as you're sort of thinking about policy and thinking about approaches that will potentially might become OSHA regulations down the road, but at least become policy. So I had a wonderful chance. It was in the toward the end of May this last year, the National Academy of Science has a subcommittee that's looking at the use of elastomeric respirators as an alternative respiratory protection for healthcare, which is not currently used by very many places, and they're looking at whether this would help us both provide a better respirator for healthcare and deal with potential shortages of N95 respirators. And so we had this sort of, I was able to go and I spoke to the committee, and we had some good interaction talking about that. So that's really feels good to do that sort of work.
Right, right. Yeah. You've placed your hand on so many different things across the country, Mark, in the years that you've done this work. What are some of your high points, as in, you know, impacts that you made that you're proud of, or that you were part of? You know, your hand was at least laying somewhere on that curve of change that, you know, that's something you're really proud of. What are some of those?
Yeah, no, I've been really lucky to work with, as I, you know, said earlier, with some really good organizations, and mostly work with really wonderful coworkers and colleagues in the places I've been. So some of the highlights, I think, as I look back, one of the things I got involved with early on when I moved to Alaska was there was the development of asbestos training programs for AHERA, and then broader. And then following up with that, there's training programs for HAZWOPER and lead, and, you know, lots of other things. But in the mid 80s, a lot of those training programs that I was involved in Alaska were with the construction trades and with their labor management training funds. And a big part of what we were doing was training some of their experienced members to become trainers, peer trainers, to be able to have, you know, more capacity to do the training. And so, and I've done that with HAZWOPER and lots of other programs up until just my most recent job with service employees. And so that's been, I think, a real highlight is helping rank and file members, helping frontline supervisors, you know, learn enough about health and safety and practice to become good trainers and to help spread this work. And then part of that is they then learn how to resolve, you know, issues, resolve health and safety problems, and to know when they need to call in for more help, and then who to call. And so that's been something I think has been a real, really wonderful part of sort of my work over time, has been the working with peer trainers and helping them grow the capacity to do our work.
Right, right. I often refer to it as teaching people to fish, you know.
Yeah.
But we're not fishing safety, fishing health. We're passing along the information. I love that part. I that's really fulfilling to me as well.
Yeah.
And so I
remember getting a call with someone with the laborers union that I worked with in Alaska, and he'd been through our training, had been a peer trainer, was kind of working on health and safety, and he called me one day after hours, and he said, you know, we had this lead exposure job. This was like 87 before the lead rules really kicked in from OSHA and EPA. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I realize lead is sort of like asbestos, not exactly, but he explained to me what they had done to protect workers on the job he was a supervisor on. And it was like perfect. It was like the perfect thing to do. And where he was, you know, where he hadn't done what I would have done, he was more protective because he was realizing that, you know, I'm kind of out of my depth here. So, you know, to see people both be able to do to kind of take what they've learned and apply it to a work site and then apply it to a different type of work site and do a good job of it really does give you the sense that, you know, we're on the right track here with the peer trainers and helping frontline workers and supervisors kind of learn more about how to do this work. And there's plenty of work for us as professionals. You know, we need these folks' help.
We absolutely do.
Yeah.
Earlier this summer, actually, I was in a social setting in my community, and my partner and I were at a public event, and he was introducing me to a man that was on a board with him, and I said, well, I actually know who that is. I said I remember him as being a company. I inspected his company many years ago as an investigator, and I said he and I had this really powerful experience talking about silica. They were it was a masonry company. And this man had inherited his business from his dad. And, you know, silica was a big deal at the time I was doing, it was coming back as a big deal, rather, at the time I was doing my inspections in the 90s. And he was absolutely shocked when I was telling him what the hazards of silica were. And he's like, why did we not ever know this? And yeah. You know, what, you know, like my dad didn't know, oh my gosh, what do I have to do? And so fast forward to this social setting, my partner introduces me to him, and the guy's like, yeah, nice to meet you, Jill. And I said, you know, I remember you. You might not remember me. And then I said, remember, I'm the OSHA lady, because that's what everybody called me. And he goes, oh my gosh, yes, I do remember you. And he's like, brings his wife over. He's like, Julie, do you remember Jill, the OSHA lady? And they're like, yes. And then he said, do you remember about silica? And I said, yes, I do. it's very clear in my mind. There was this big aha moment that I couldn't believe that a mason didn't know about this major hazard that they were working with, which again, helped shift and craft the way that I did my work, which was assume nothing. You know, just because it was his craft and industry didn't mean that he knew everything about that.
Yeah.
And so that was just really sort of it changed the way that they did their work that time.
And
it was kind of fun to revisit that. And I wasn't reviled as the OSHA lady that day.
Yeah, that's nice, Dee. It's nice to have it be, there's some positive outcome to our work, because it's, you know, certainly there's this public portrayal that our work is always adversarial, or OSHA's work is adversarial, union work is adversarial. And you know, it is at times, but in many cases that people don't hear about, our work is very collaborative, and you know, we can still fight inside that collaboration, but the outcomes can be very positive for workplace safety and health.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just thinking, you reminded me of in 1988 or 89 or so, I was working with construction workers in Alaska and some of their contractors in the oil fields, and found out that they had knew almost nothing about benzene and the hazards of benzene. And OSHA was, you know, had just recently updated their benzene standard, but there had been a lawsuit back in the late 70s and early late 70s when OSHA tried to update their benzene standard the first time, and led to a Supreme Court decision. And then years later, there was a new final standard. Many of the workers and managers had just thought this had come out of nowhere. They had no idea what the long history had been. And so we would do some training and talk about the history. And they were both fascinated, but sort of appalled in the same way that, oh my gosh, how come we didn't know this for 15 years? Why is this brand new to us?
Right. Very interesting. Yeah. So, Mark, when you had mentioned that you got this great opportunity in Seattle at the university, and you left Alaska to take that.
Yeah.
Was that kind of your first job that you had where you weren't having this vast exposure to all these different types of employment settings, or am I guessing wrong there?
It was really different. You know, I working in an occupational medicine clinic at the University of Washington. And it was we were a research center. We trained occupational medicine docs, and then we provide patient services in the Northwest on occupational disease and some on back injuries and safety and health, but mostly the focus was disease. And so what was different was I suddenly wasn't going out to work sites very often. But what was happening is sick workers were coming into our clinic. And so we saw lots of workers with asbestosis and potential lung cancer and some mesothelioma cases. We saw lead poisoning. Solvent exposures were very common. And so lots of indoor air cases. This was in the early 90s, and a lot of indoor air issues. We saw lots of asthma and sort of environmental sensitivity cases from around the Northwest, from things like crab asthma, which is in the crab processing from Alaska, was a common disorder.
Who knew?
And to radiator, you know, workers in radiator shops getting lead poisoning, and then, you know, the historic asbestos diseases that were showing up just because of the long history of asbestos use in the Pacific Northwest. And we were seeing people who had started their exposures during World War II and workplaces or the military, and then there's a culmination mm-hmm. of that. So it was this, you know, I always urge my young colleagues or students to, if you get a chance as a hygienist to work or spend time in an occupational medicine clinic, please go do that, because the, you know, most of us, until you do that, you don't really see the people that have the diseases that result from the failure of health and safety work. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it was mm-hmm. a fascinating observation on our profession and our work. It was great to work with the physicians and the occupational medicine docs. And it was really fun to work with the occupational medicine fellows who were in training. And because we were at the university, we would work with the other divisions of the School of Public Health. So I'd have a chance to work with the industrial hygiene faculty and students, undergraduate and graduate, and the occupational mm-hmm. health nursing faculty and students. And so it was this wonderful collaboration. And then we worked closely with all sorts of other, you know, state agencies, some federal agencies, lots of private sector employers and organizations sure. on safety and health. But it was a really different role, because suddenly my role was to explore the exposure histories of workers coming in, to help the docs understand the relationship to the symptoms and the signs they were seeing. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't prevention. It was really sort of after the fact. And you know, we try to do prevention, but it's difficult in an occupational medicine clinic to kind of lead course. On prevention. You're mostly dealing with people who have problems, and you're kind of dealing with that very kind
yeah,
of
reacting.
Much more narrow mm-hmm. focus. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was. But I say if you get a chance as a hygienist to go work in a clinic and take exposure histories and work with docs, it's a really wonderful way to sort of broaden the experience of our profession and mm-hmm. see how we can play a stronger role with occupational medicine docs in terms of yeah. understanding controls and understanding exposures.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. I spent about 3 years in an occupational medicine clinic as well,
yeah.
and
yeah.
Don't regret any of that time, as well as workers' compensation case management, because it gave you kind
yes.
of a similar glimpse into that, and so that was very powerful. Powerful learning experience for me as well.
Yeah,
Mark, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And it's part of my work in the clinic. Even though I was the industrial hygienist, I was the primary one to deal with workers' comp, because that was just kind of
sure.
how it had evolved, which is
yeah. made sense.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, I was fortunate in that the state of Washington has a state based workers' comp system that probably mm-hmm. functioned as better than most states, and so. There was, especially around the issue of asbestos disease, there was a small group of case managers who dealt with anything that had the word asbestos on it that went into the state workers' comp system. They dealt with, so they actually knew what was going on. They knew how to, they knew what evidence we needed to provide. They knew about the treatments, and they were, so that was really helpful. But it's a whole other part of our work that I hadn't really seen much before. So workers' comp.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it's good work.
Yeah.
So you were in the Pacific Northwest. You're currently in Maryland on the other end of the country. Did you had you mapped out your career as to how you were going to end up on the East Coast, or how did that work for you? I'm assuming there's a lot of years between, but you went from one end to the other.
Yeah.
What are the highlights of those stops?
Yeah, I sort of never had a strict career plan other than have work I really like doing, and certainly and would look and, you know, and when opportunities showed up for other good work, I would be happy to move on. And so I ended mm-hmm. up being out west for almost 20 years. And so there were two things happening. One was I was at the University of Washington at the OCMED clinic for a couple of years. After a couple of years, not being so directly involved in prevention started to kind of seem like that's something I needed to go back to. So I ended up leaving the university, and at the end of my time in Seattle, I was actually working for a private sector consulting firm that did occupational environmental health. And part of the reason for doing that work was there were a lot of really good colleagues who worked at the firm in Seattle, the Prezon Associates, and they've since been bought out and dissolved. But the other part was I had a lot of colleagues who worked in the private sector say, well, you've mostly worked for unions – nonprofits, the university, you don't really know the real
world.
And so I worked for this consulting firm, and you know, that may not be the real world either, but essentially what I what I was happy to find was that we could do the same level of health and safety work in much of the same way that I did working for a union at the consulting firm. You know, the language would be a little different, but you know, I was often working with frontline supervisors or mid-level managers on how to resolve issues. And you know, they were at least the people we worked with, the employers, were people who wanted our services. They were paying us to help them solve problems. And so if you're looking on problem solving, then you know, then that's easier. You know, we weren't working for companies that were going to hire us who were trying to hide their problem and from people. We were a company that actually was pretty well known. We were expensive, but we were well known as people we could help you out. And so so it was good to see that I could, you know, that you could work for the consulting firm, number one, do good work, and do the work in the same way that you could in other areas of our work, and you know, have a good impact. And so so I was there for a couple of years, and then I was working with them a couple of years, and then there was this opportunity to come to the East Coast and to work for another small nonprofit that was also one of these committees on occupational safety and health, like I had worked with in Alaska, but it was based in D.C. And they were doing a huge amount of training of workers and training peer trainers around the country to do occupational safety and health work. And it was called the Alice Hamilton Center. And so I took the chance. And I also, after 20 years out west, it felt like moving closer to my siblings and closer to my family was time to do that. So I moved back to the DC area where I've been ever since.
Wow. So for anyone who's been listening to Mark share his story and you're thinking, wow, I'd like to get inside that guy's head or like just sit next to him and hear about all of this history, because as you're telling your stories, Mark, you're weaving in all of these historic facts that kind of go along with, you know, like, how did we get where we were in the country at that time? How did these things come to be? And kind of leaning into the background of how all of this happened. And so I'm interested for you to tell your story about how and why you started curating a collection of historic videos about workplace safety.
Yeah, this has been one of the really, really wonderful parts of the last 15 years. And so when I started work in 81 and sort of was you know, kind of new to health and safety, and I was the start of my work coincided with sort of a real burst of publications, articles and books about the history of our profession. And so there were some historians at Columbia University who are still around who've done just wonderful books on the history of health and safety, and there was lots of interesting research coming out, and so I was fascinated by that, and I started, you know, so I would start reading the histories and the histories of old industrial hygienists who had been around since the 30s and 40s, and the AIHA had put out a book on sort of history of our profession, and that came out in the mid 80s. So I started reading these things, and they were fascinating. So as I was teaching various classes, I would try to interject some of the history because I found it interesting, and oftentimes students found it interesting. And so I kept doing that. And one of the things that happens just because you're in the profession and you get older is there were training films and things that that OSHA had put out and some other agency had put out in the early 80s, and that we'd use them in teaching. And then it's now the late 90s, and people are looking at, I'm still looking at these as new and interesting films, and the student reaction is, oh, these are really old, and this is like, were you around when these were made? And like, well, they didn't used to be old films, so I started picking up, you know, both getting older that needed to really talk about things as incorporating history. And then when I was working with the Service Employees International Union, and we had a training grant with a wonderful federal program called the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences Worker Training Program, and it's a cooperative grant program that that still exists, and it's really just wonderful collaboration between public and private sector. And it was 2006, and YouTube had come out, and mm-hmm. the director of this training grant program, the NIHS, a public servant named Chip Hughes, he put out a call because he was always looking at this new technology, and he said, is YouTube something we could use for teaching? Would it be a good resource? Mm-hmm. How could we think about using this? And so I volunteered as one of the grantees. I volunteered to explore YouTube as a film resource, as a resource.
Wow.
And so I uploaded, because one of the reasons was I was sort of not a technophile, so I figured if I could do it, most people could do it. So I went to YouTube and read some stuff, and I uploaded some films that I had digitized that were old films I had used in the early 80s from OSHA, and mm-hmm. uploaded them, and it was easy. And so I uploaded some more, and it was it was becoming a good resource. At one point, YouTube emailed me and said I had a channel, which is the channel we've talked about. And so I said, oh, well, that's cool. And so I just kept uploading stuff. I kept finding interesting films and materials. And then a colleague let me know that who had done some film work had let me know that not far from where I lived on the University of Maryland campus in College Park was the United States Archive Film Library, where they had 300,000 films.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I went there and found out it was not hard to get access to the films. And then you could, with a little bit of equipment, you could actually digitize old films from their archive and take them home with you. And they were almost all in the public domain. So I then started just this serious hobby of adding films from World War II films on gas masks and chemical warfare from like 1919 to films on how to put a gas mask on your horse from the military from World War II.
Oh my gosh.
And then a whole range of other, occupational health and safety films. I found an old film from the Civilian Conservation Corps from like 1936 on safety and health and CCC work. And just this whole range of stuff that I just found fascinating, and it really fed my interest in history. So that this film channel, which I continue to maintain as a resource for our profession and for trainers, now has over 1,100 films on it. It's had almost 9 million hits over the past 12 years, and I continue to add to it. I just added a film recently. I was mentioning to you before we started this. A film on histoplasmosis from the 1950s, which talks about farmers developing histoplasmosis from their exposure to dust and how to control that dust. So this is like something we still do today, right? We still recognize
it. Absolutely is.
So we did a podcast earlier in the year about the film channels, and so I think we can link people to that.
Right,
and
I would
encourage people to go to my site, take a look at the films, to get a better sense of the history of our profession of occupational environmental health, but then, where you can use them in your teaching, either teaching professionals or teaching workers or managers. I think it can become a wonderful resource for people, and I hope people use it. I'm going to continue to do this into my retirement. It's really fun.
Exactly. So the name of Mark's YouTube channel is Historic Workplace and Environmental Safety and Health Films. And Mark had referred a moment ago that he and I did a webcast earlier this year, which we did together. It's called Heroes in Safety. But I had gotten so interested in listening to Mark's stories about the history of our profession that I asked him if we could do a webcast together about it and highlight some of what we ended up calling the heroes in safety. So dating back quite a ways and just kind of marching through history and highlighting a number of people who were really game changers to occupational health and safety across our country. And you had mentioned earlier, Mark, that you worked at the Alice Hamilton Center as one of the things that brought you to the East Coast. And I know we talked about Alice Hamilton in our webcast together. Do you want to give our audience just sort of a glimpse as to what Alice, some of the contributions Alice had
made?
Oh,
sure. Yeah. And the organization I worked for had been named after her. So Alice Hamilton was an occupational medicine doc who did her work in around 1910 up until she died in 1970. And she was mostly active from about 1910 until the mid 40s. But Dr. Hamilton was a rarity. She was a female doctor, which was unusual at the time. Most medical schools didn't allow women to be doctors, but she did that work. She was raised. She grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Went to medical school at the University of Michigan, and was a physician who worked at Hull House, the house that worked with immigrant, the community that worked with immigrant workers in the Chicago area, and that's where she got her introduction to occupational health issues. She was appointed to an Illinois commission in around 1910, 1911, to look at occupational disease in Illinois, and then that propelled her, that work propelled her to the national stage and the international stage as a premier occupational safety and health doc. And a lot of her work actually was not as a physician. A lot of her work was more more what we'd call an industrial hygienist today, doing workplace inspections and looking at the environment and looking at controls, as opposed to just, you know, looking at workers who have illness and disease. So Dr. Hamilton was involved in work during World War II on health and safety and munitions work. She did a lot of work on solvent exposure and lead exposures into the 30s. In 1919, she was appointed to a position at the School of Public Health at Harvard, and she was the first female faculty member at Harvard. And and so that's one of her claims to fame. But she's been she was someone who I learned early on in our profession as a most amazing historical figure. And, you know, she has a biography that came out on Exploring the Dangerous Trades, which is really a must for anyone who's a student or in our profession. That's a really wonderful thing, a book to read. Mm-hmm. There was a book of her letters. She was a renowned correspondent, and so there's huge numbers of her letters that go back and forth on both her health and safety and other work. That's a fascinating read. And then just 2 years ago, a colleague at the University of Illinois found a recording of an interview with her in 1963.
I was just going to ask you about that, yes.
Yeah, and we played part of that on the webcast. So in 1963, there was a series of interviews that were recorded, oral histories of faculty who had been founders of the Harvard School of Public Health. And so there's about an hour and a half interview with her at her home in Connecticut with a dog barking in the background. And she's 93, but her voice is still pretty strong. And so we've put a little bit of that up onto the website, up onto the channel for people to look at. And we have plans when we get a chance to put more of that up, because she tells stories about doing occupational health work, you know, in the decades before OSHA, when there was no legal right to do to access it as an outsider, and to do work in, you know, in lots of industries where health and safety was certainly not, especially the health issues were not viewed as important issues to work on or worth work. And so it's she's one of the heroes of that I have, and lots of, I think, other folks have in our profession, because she's a really wonderful, wonderful historical figure to look at.
Thank you so much for starting and maintaining that YouTube channel for us all to be able to access, to look back at our own history and where did we come from in this profession that we chose and continue to work on. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope folks will take a look at the channel and use it and contact me if they have any questions.
Absolutely. So, Mark, as we're getting ready to wrap up today, and you're looking at this lengthy career and all of its stopping points literally across the country, is there any particular advice that you'd have for people now in our profession, or maybe even someone just starting out?
Yeah, and I'm not done yet. I have a few more good years in me, I hope. And in
right,
my consulting
absolutely.
Work, but I think the advice that I got early on from some wonderful older mentor was to take opportunities that show up and just go for it. And not to be, you know, especially early on, not to be too concerned about making the wrong choice, because you just make choices. And so that, you know, that sort of following that advice led me to Alaska to do wonderful work. That then led me to the University of Washington to do, again, wonderful work. And it's led me to keep finding really, you know, wonderful places to work and wonderful colleagues to work with. So I would say for people just to be open to opportunities that show up, you know, do the preparation, prepare yourself, you know, both technically and like public speaking, and then just see where it goes. It's sort of luck, but it's also you're prepared for the opportunities that show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good advice, Mark. Good advice. Thank you. So this has been Mark, industrial hygienist, who's just getting started.
Thank you, Jill. This has been remarkable to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, I really appreciate your time. And thank you all so much for joining in and listening today. And thank you for the work that you all do to make sure workers make it home safe every day. You can listen to all of our episodes at vividlearningsystems.com or subscribe in the podcast player of your choosing. If you have a suggestion for a guest, including maybe if it's even you, please contact me at social@vividlearningsystems.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.